thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 15 for the 6th of November 2007. Exposing yourself. I'm Dan Cohen. And we're back after a few weeks break from Digital Campus. And I'm Dan Cohen from the Center for History and New Media. I'm joined by two of my colleagues at the Center for History and New Media, as always, Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
And probably a lot of our listeners know this, but some may not, but the founder and director of the Center for History and New Media, Roy Rosenzweig, passed away in the week since our last recording. And, you know, we wanted to mention that. It's been a tough month, I think, for everyone at the Center for History and New Media. And we had thought about devoting a podcast to Roy, but I think we've all said a lot on our blogs. We did want to mention that there's a wonderful site that the staff at the Center for History and New Media has put up for those who want to learn about Roy and those who knew Roy who want to post photos or recollections about Roy or just tell some funny stories. That's at thanksroy.org. And after thinking about doing a podcast on Roy, we realized that we're going to, you know, say some more in a memorial celebration that will be in December, and we've always thought that what Roy would want the most would be for everyone at the Center for History and New Media to do what they do and to move on and do the work that he loves so much. And he liked listening to this podcast, and I think really one of the best ways to honor Roy is to do what we do and to get on with the podcast. And so we're going to go ahead and do that, but with the understanding that for people who haven't done it yet, really encourage everyone to go to Thanks Roy and to read. I think all three of us have posted recollections of Roy and appreciations of Roy. And, you know, I think we can all say, Tom and Mills, I'm sure I speak for both of you, that, you know, we're just incredibly happy that we had the time that we did with Roy, and that we, you know, we're lucky to work at the Center for History and New Media, George Mason, and something that he founded, and that's really expanded from just Roy, actually, at the beginning in 1994, to over 40 people working full or part-time here. It's a really exciting place, and so we're just greatly appreciative to Roy for everything he's done. And, you know, I think that's what we wanted to just say up front. Again, for those who want to contribute, please do visit thanksroy.org. So it has been a few weeks, and a lot has happened in the tech and education world, and we wanted to dig right in. No, Roy would have liked to install this, since we're all Mac heads here, but the new edition of the Mac operating system, Leopard, came out last week. And I haven't upgraded yet. Tom Mills, have you upgraded?
I have not. I have. I did it yesterday afternoon. So
I never upgrade at the first opportunity. Never.
Yeah. I always do, and it's usually a mistake. But in this case, I don't think it was a mistake. I think, you know, this thing is running pretty beautifully. I did a clean install. I backed up all my files, my home directory, wiped and repartitioned the hard drive and reinstalled. And it's working really, really very well. There's some nice new features. There's some things that I really recommend. There's some things that I'm not 100% sure of, but But it went pretty easily. I know Jeremy Boggs, one of our developers here, he also upgraded and he had some problems, specifically because he was running MySQL and PHP locally on his machine, and that I guess really caused some problems with the upgrade. I think he just did the kind of upgrade on top of the old operating system rather than wiping clean and starting from scratch, but. So far, so good for me. I mean, I think that it's real pretty and seems to work pretty well.
And so what are the I'm going to upgrade today. So, of course, I'm although this is a podcast, so aren't we allowed to talk about things we haven't done yet in some way?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
It's right. Podcasting and blogging sometimes reminds me of the old professor's joke about, one professor asking the other professor, have you read this book yet? And the other professor says, read it? I haven't even taught it yet. one of those old but bad professorial jokes. But looking over it, I think there are actually a number of features. It's not a revolutionary upgrade, but I think for the academic community, I think this brings a lot of pretty interesting features that actually address some of what we've talked about on the podcast before. Things like spaces, which, I've always seen spaces, which is the ability to have kind of multiple desktops that you can switch back and forth to. I've always seen that on Linux and, what would I really use it for? But, as with everything Mac, they've just sort of taken an idea that's been out there and the realm of operating systems for a while and just made it look a lot better and I think more usable, the ability to, for instance, drag Windows from one space to another, but I think for me that and the addition of to-do lists right within Mail, which I use my Mail program almost like a to-do list as is. I set up folders for messages that I have to respond to or actions that I need to take, and I think and I know Tom, you're a getting things done advocate. It seems like they've added a bunch of features that help you get things done. Keep a workflow right within your Mail client. And that, along with the ability to isolate a particular task in what they're calling a space or a separate desktop, seems to me to be pretty critical. I've always wanted just a dedicated window just for writing because I always have my Mail client open and my instant messaging client open and my web browser. And so whenever I try to write, which I'm now trying to get back into, you're distracted by all these other windows.
I think most of the improvements and upgrades that the kind of average user are going to notice are these kind of productivity upgrades. The to-do lists in Mail, the spaces. There's the new cover flow view for the file system, so you can get a little preview of each document, actually look inside each document and kind of flip through them the way you would flip through album covers, and which has been built into iTunes now for maybe a year. There's this feature called Quick Look, which if you kind of mouse over a document on your desktop or anywhere in the file system and hit the space bar, it gives you a full screen, a very kind of quick full screen preview of what's in the document. So if the file name doesn't make sense to you or you can't remember quite what's in there, it's very easy to get that kind of a preview. So there are a lot of these productivity enhancements, I think. What I've been told, but I don't have the technical knowledge to know this, but is that the real importance of the Leopard upgrade is under the hood, and that it's going to that there's things like core animation, which is going to make it much, much easier for third party application developers to develop kind of visually rich and animated applications. And so I think what people are saying is that the real impact of Leopard is going to be felt some months down the road as application developers get their hands on all these tools that are built in under the hood and start developing Leopard specific applications. And I think that's when it's gonna be really really good.
Uh-huh. So this is equivalent to Vista's sort of Aeroglass or these UI updates that have been made.
I think so, and I think it's also there's kind of developer kits built into the operating system, that lots of hooks and things that are going to make it very easy to, you know how sometimes in the past like non-Apple applications have looked kind of different than the Apple applications, where the Apple applications were all, you know, nice and polished and shiny and kind of
right.
very, very coherent. I think they've kind of built hooks to all of those things, so that third party developers will be able to develop applications that fit with the operating system just as well. So I think that's when we're going to see some really great things.
Yeah, I also think, you know, the Time Machine, which is a little bit goofy when you look at it, but this is their new backup software, and it looks like you're on the Starship Enterprise as stars go by, and I mean it's actually pretty visually arresting, but going back in time you see sort of windows that are your machine in prior incarnations as you go back through time to retrieve, for instance, a file that you deleted. Now, of course, again, this is something that's been around in computer science forever. You know, for a long time I used to back up with a command line utility called rsync, which I assume Time Machine is just, you know, a graphical version of rsync, because, you know, Mac OS X is Unix under the hood, and I assume they're just using one of these Unix utilities for backing up. They've made it look really good. But again, isn't this what Apple does really well? I mean, they just take something that's kind of been out there and make it so visually nice looking that you want to use it. And I know so many people who do not back up that having something that looks this good and that is this easy, you just plug in a hard drive, it says, do you want this to be a Time Machine? And you say yes, and that's it. You know, doesn't that just make it used more?
For sure it'll make it a lot easier for me, because I'm one of those people. I have to constantly remind myself about doing my backups. So to have something that simple is really going to be a bonus for me.
Right. Right. Yeah, right now I'm using SuperDuper, which I think is, you know, the best backup program out there. You know, I might stick with SuperDuper. I think the one problem with Time Machine is that it does a backup every hour as its default setting. And the problem is then you, of course, need the hard drive to be plugged in. And for me, I just, you know, I don't know, at least I don't know about your hard drives, but they're a little bit noisy, and if you keep them cycling all the time and they'll kick in, kick off, it can be a little bit annoying. I think that's the only problem. And also, so many of us have laptops now rather than desktop machines, right, that, you know, you got to remember, okay, I'm in my office, I got to plug in my Time Machine. you know, Stephen Fry, the British actor, comedian, all-around Renaissance guy, he's got a great blog post at stephenfry.com just about this capacity for Apple to just, you know, take something that's been out there, like the cell phone, for instance, most recently, and, you know, through design, make it something that's appreciated and used more than, you know, not necessarily adding new features, but making them used through just excellence in design. I guess that's what Apple's core strength is.
I mean, the iPod was the same thing, where there were plenty of MP3 players before the iPod came out. They just did it better than everyone else, and actually created a market for MP3 players, which had been around but never really sold until the iPod came around. So there is a lot of precedent for that.
Does Leopard start to make inroads on campuses or in libraries, museums? Do these features help out at all, or is there still a kind of basic purchasing equation that's going on here where, you know, cheap PCs and Vista, which I suppose we should talk about, having been out for 9 months, but doesn't seem to be really at least taking over our campus, or I don't see a lot of students running it.
It's not supported. We can't put it on our machines, on machines that are on the network, GMU machines that are on the network. I actually just asked our lab manager, you know, why haven't we upgraded to Vista? And he said, you know, they're not supporting it yet. So it is pretty startling that 9 months on from the release, campuses just aren't switching. Sorry, Mills.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to say, and I even have students who are downgrading. They're finding it frustrating to use. I had a student in my office yesterday saying that she just can't stand the new word processor interface, the new Word interface, that a paper that she said should have taken her about 45 minutes to type and format ended up taking her close to 2 hours. And so she'd made up her mind that was the last straw. She was going to downgrade. And she's, the third student I've talked to who said that they were going back.
That's fascinating. I mean, I think, you know, the core strength of Microsoft and the reason it's been valued so much more highly than Apple is, you know, they're always concerned about, you know, the corporate network and making sure, you know, backwards compatibility with applications going all the way back to MS-DOS. And it seemed to me when Vista came out, and also it really began, didn't it, more than a year ago when they released IE7, Internet Explorer 7, their browser, and they went to this very new-look interface, which was, I think, almost Mac-esque. You know, it was stripped down. There were fewer menus. I mean, they finally started to listen to people who were saying, oh, you know, it's Microsoft has corporate software. It's bloated. It's got all this administrative graphical junk around the window that you're trying to use. And so they finally listened to this, and with IE, and now with, you know, if you look at the new version of Word, it's also streamlined. And so from someone who comes from the Mac environment, I think, wow, this looks really great, but I can totally see, you know, people who are used to XP and, you know, old versions of Office, it's sort of like, where has all this stuff gone? It disappears in it. The learning curve is suddenly a lot higher. So, you know, Microsoft has a real trouble switching gears into this more streamlined design-oriented mode.
Yeah, I agree, Dan. I really like Vista. I think it looks great. I think it works pretty well. My wife has a new machine that has Vista on it, and you know, I actually really enjoy it. But I think it could be because I'm coming from a Mac perspective. I think, you know, a lot of those menus and things in the old Microsoft user interfaces, you know, there was a lot of redundancy. You know, there was like six ways to do everything, and they always got slammed by people like us because, you know, why should there be six ways to do things when you really need only one? But I think that helped kind of your average users. I mean, I think, you know, we tend to look at these things from kind of a power user perspective because we're in this field of digital humanities and we are kind of computer geeks. But I think for maybe average users, it's kind of nice to have, you know, a save button in four places, because then you figure out which one works for you, and then you use it and you remember to save your documents. I think you're absolutely right. The stripping down of this may have caused some problems for people.
Right. Well, and my sense is that Microsoft has now had to extend the life of Windows XP considerably because corporations and universities are kind of hedging on this a little bit. They don't want to upgrade. They see a lot of problems. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next year. I mean, another story that broke in the last couple of weeks since our last podcast was that the UK computer agency Becta started advising school systems to not sign licensing agreements with Microsoft. And this is a little bit of blowback from the kind of anti-competitive, you know, Microsoft's been hauled into court several times in the EU. But I think now this is sort of finally starting to get traction that there's, you know, I think also with not only the Mac OS, but also Ubuntu, you know, looking really good. I think, again, you know, here's a case where the Linux Ubuntu release, you know, took, you know, Linux has now been out for, you know, 15 years, and they took this open source operating system and put a really good looking desktop, you know, icons, everything on top of that, made it a little bit easier to use, and all of a sudden it's having this tremendous success. And so, you know, here comes Becta along saying, hey, wait a second, you know, we spent all this money to license Microsoft products, you know, what, you know, and in particular, they were worried about Office 2007 and Vista. And they said, wait a second, maybe this is a time to reconsider our options here and perhaps look at open source alternatives. You know, I think that, you know, there's a lot of play right now in terms of operating systems that are going to get installed on campuses. And I think it's just an open question what's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I, I it's a lot of European governments, I think, and I know like the Brazilian government and others are starting to really seriously consider and starting in some cases to insist on Linux and open source alternatives to Microsoft and even Apple and others. I personally have Ubuntu running in Parallels on my Mac, and I personally don't think it's quite there yet. I mean, I think it does everything you need it to do. It's a little difficult to install applications, but if you figure that out, there are plenty of applications to run. But it kind of, if you're happy kind of working in what basically looks like Windows 95, then it does everything you need to do. And I think we could all still run Windows 95 or probably Windows 98 because it has USB support, but we could run those old operating systems and be, you know, perfectly productive and be able to do everything it is we need to do. But I don't think any of us would be all that happy working in Windows 98 anymore. but I do think for developing countries and school districts possibly, or poorer school districts, these open source alternatives, they're getting there. They're getting to the point where they have all the functionality. But they definitely don't have kind of the user friendliness and the eye candy and all of the things I think especially kids really want to see. So I think the Becta might be a little bit premature in just rejecting Microsoft products. And I suspect we haven't heard the end of that story.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Yep, I would agree.
Well, I suppose the biggest story of the last 2 weeks has just been all the news around Facebook, which has just made a huge charge in the last year toward relevancy. Well, it was already very relevant among our students, but at least us old people started buying in. I think that's when things really took off on Facebook over the past years, when they opened up to non-college students and then had their numbers, you know, expand by a significant multiple. I think going from 8 or 10 million people using Facebook, you know, essentially the entire college population and much of the other, you know, high school and other school population out to really just anyone who wanted to sign up. And, you know, now they're in the tens of millions. I can't remember the last number I saw, but I think they're somewhere around 50 or 60 million, still half the number of MySpace, but clearly they're growing very rapidly, and there's been a lot of interest in, you know, buying Facebook and buying into Facebook, which indeed Microsoft did for the stunning amount of $240 million for, from what I understand, just about 1.5% of the company, which values it at $15 billion with a B, quite a remarkable number. But beyond the money question, I think what also has happened that I think really got our interest is that really this story, I mean, the reason there's big money surrounding Facebook is, of course, Facebook as an advertising platform. All of its revenue comes from advertisements that are posted on the site. And Microsoft, of course, is right now providing those advertisements. I think part of what they were buying into was a long-term deal to provide ads on Facebook. And at the same time, over the last couple of weeks, we saw a couple of launches that I think are really going to shake up the advertising industry. And they really relate to what's going, I think, on campus in terms of anonymity and privacy. First of all, Facebook, of course, had launched over in the spring or early summer, had launched their Facebook application platform, which has been an enormous success for Facebook and indeed for many developers who've signed up to produce Facebook applications. And that's, of course, a closed platform that you write applications into. And what Google and MySpace and LinkedIn and High Five and all these other very worried other players in the social networking space did over the past couple of weeks is sort of band together and create something called Open Social, which, like Facebook Application Platform, is a includes a set of APIs. You use HTML and JavaScript to create applications. And, of course, as the name implies, Open Social, an Open Social application can be embedded into any of the participating social networks. So once this gets going, you can embed a Open Social application in Orkut, which is Google's social networking site, or MySpace with its 100 million people, or Friendster, or LinkedIn, which has tens of millions of people. And it, you sort of write one once, and it will run on all these things. And Facebook, to, I think, justify this $15 billion valuation of their company, is going to put out something called social ads. And I think really what's happening here is that they are finally leveraging to the fullest extent. They're already started to do this since they have ads on the site. But social ads is going to take into account all that personal information that you've put into your Facebook account. You know, they know what movies you like. They know what bands you like. They know who you're friends with. They have all this information. And I think for me, what I've seen over the last year, and I think this is very typical, is that, as Google has grown and, its stock went way up this week to over $700, they're now the fifth most valuable company in the United States. People always, I think, attack the big guy. And there's been a lot of critics of Google. And in particular, the criticism of Google has been one about privacy, that Google has all this information. You do all these searches on Google, and they know what you're interested in. But my goodness, Facebook has much better information, as far as I can tell, than Google does. I mean, you Google things, all kinds of things on Google. But Facebook really knows what you're interested in, and they've got all this information about what your friends are interested in and what you're posting to their walls, and what groups you join. I know lots of us, Tom and I are from Boston, and so we joined the Red Sox Nation group. Facebook knows that we are Red Sox fans. Google would have a very hard time figuring that out from the searches I've done on it.
Yeah.
So we wanted to discuss in this feature segment of the podcast this question about privacy and anonymity. And, I know that at least on George Mason's campus, our information technology group is, constantly worried about privacy and security and anonymity. But my goodness, they've got all these students who come in with these Facebook accounts, and they're exposing themselves to the world with all these, very specific aspects of their lives. I mean, they're really having themselves out there. I wonder, what do we think is going to happen with this as, social networks like Facebook know more and more about us and are able to cobble together this information? That's a topic. So maybe we'll just start with Facebook. I mean, both of you are on Facebook as well. Do you worry about this? Do you do anything to protect your privacy on Facebook? Tom, maybe we'll start with you.
I don't do anything. I think I'm like most of the average users who kind of, I guess I knew that there were privacy settings, but I just, kind of didn't bother. And I think most people probably are using it the same way. So yeah, I'm worried kind of in the abstract about privacy, but I have to say I do almost nothing to protect it on my own. I mean, I have imported all of my mail into Gmail, so Google knows pretty much everything I've said and done for the last, almost 10 years. And Facebook, I post all kinds of stuff there. I import my blog feed. I, sign up for Red Sox Nation. I have all friends. I think we're all kind of concerned vaguely about privacy, but I think very few of us are probably doing anything to protect it.
Mills, how about you? Do you use any of the privacy settings?
I protect myself somewhat in that I actually post less information on Facebook than I post on my you know, through like that you could cobble together through my regular website. So, you know, if you went to my website, you could get a, you could look at my CV and see, you know, where I worked, and you could see what I've published and that sort of thing, and what my office address is and phone number. But I put, I guess the only information that's on my Facebook site or page that is not available on my website is what my IM address is. But other than that, there's actually less information available on my Facebook page, although there's still a lot. I mean, there's still kind of a lot of casual information, you know, like instead of the Red Sox Nation, I'm part of a UVA alumni sports group and that sort of thing. So they would know that I'm a sports fan, but which wouldn't be apparent from my website. But other than that, you know, I mean, what amazes me is how many people on Facebook have their date of birth posted, because that's such a crucial piece of information right. for anybody who wants to do some identity theft.
Yep.
Having your date of birth is really a crucial piece of information. And so, you know, with the full name and the date of birth and some other information, you could actually start trying to swipe somebody's identity. So mine does not appear.
Yeah. And a lot of people may not know this, but in the past month, Facebook is now exposing profile pages to Google. So maybe these worlds aren't that separate. I mean,
right.
unless you chose to opt out, and unfortunately with all these things, it often involves opting out. To get this, you know, to get your privacy, you have to opt out. All these companies are in the business of, you know, the default is you give them all your information. So Google will automatically enroll you in their very helpful What's Your Web History, where they retain all the history of your searches unless you opt out of that. And, of course, even if you opt out, it just means you don't, you know, there's not a page of that lists all your web searches. But, of course, they are keeping your searches in their own database. You know, this is a very troubling thing. You know, just for on Facebook, people should realize that there is a privacy page. And you can click on that and edit your settings, and you can fine-tune them pretty well. So what I've done on a lot of things is just reduce the privacy settings so that only my friends can see things like, you know, what bands I like or, you know, what I'm doing right now. But unless you do that, the default settings are very, very liberal, I guess we could call them.
One of the things that I don't quite understand, I mean, I think that the valuation of Facebook at $15 billion seems just crazy to me. But one of the things I really don't understand about it is I do agree that the ads on Facebook can be much more targeted than the ads you see on Google, because they do have this information about, you know, you, your friends, where you're providing them with more information than you provide Google. With Google, you just provide them the search terms that you happen to be looking for. With Facebook, you provide them with all this stuff about your tastes and your likes and your dislikes and your friends' tastes and their likes and their dislikes and their dates of birth and your dates, all this stuff. But when you go to Facebook, you're not looking to buy something. That's what I don't quite understand about it. And when I go to Facebook and I see these ads on the side, I really just ignore them. Like I'm just not in the marketplace when I'm on Facebook. I'm there to connect to people. I'm there to post something to my page, put up some photos, whatever. Whereas when I'm on Google, I'm often looking to buy something. I mean, I'm often looking to, you know, get directions to a restaurant. And so when the ads for restaurants pop up on the side, there's like a very good chance that I might look at them and say, oh, well, maybe I'll go to that restaurant instead. Or if I'm, you know, searching for a piece of computer equipment and the ads come up, well, then that seems to make more sense. But I just wonder just really how effective Facebook can really be in selling ads when the people using the service aren't there to buy stuff.
I think that's a great point, Tom, but I think that's exactly what this social ads platform is intended to do. I think it's intended not to be a Facebook-centric ad platform. It's intended to be a web platform, like ads like Google's AdSense, where it puts text ads on blogs. So what it's going to end up doing is it will deposit a cookie on your machine that says, you know, this machine is Dan Cohen of Facebook. and it will in a sense encode your preferences into that. And then websites that want to can buy into Facebook's social ads platform. And then when you go to, let's say, a blog that's running social ads, it will, where you actually may, let's say it's a blog about new books that are coming out, it will be able to tap into the Facebook profile and display to you an ad that you're much more likely to click on.
I see.
It's going to take all this aggregate information and push it out there into the buying realm. And I agree. I totally ignore the Facebook pages. Although, you know, you have to think that certainly, let's say, Verizon Wireless or something knows that, people 18 to 24 are much more likely to, let's say, buy their first cell phone. And so they only want to target their ads to people 18 to 24. They can only do that with Facebook. They can't do that when someone does a Google search. They have no idea how old they are. But on Facebook, they do know. And so they can, you know, display AARP ads to us soon enough.
I see. So I had misunderstood. So the deal is, if I'm on like Macy's.com or something and I'm shopping for new socks for myself, if they've signed up to the Facebook service, they, for instance, could know that my wife's birthday was yesterday, and they could say, "Did you forget your wife's birthday? Maybe you want to buy some jewelry for her."
Yeah, possibly that is conceivable. If they do this right.
Well, that could be powerful.
Yeah. I mean, they're already ramping up their within Facebook, the advertising platform, in the types of items that you can select. So you can start, you know, it used to just be I only want to display what they call flyers to George Mason students, for instance. But now you're starting very soon. You know, they're rolling out this thing where you can say, "I only want to display this to people who like you too," which is farther down in the profile than they normally allowed. But then they're going to just pop this whole thing outside of Facebook, and that's where I think the alliance with Microsoft gets really quite interesting, and I think perhaps starts to explain the valuation that Microsoft put on this deal. Is that, you know, you combine that with Microsoft's, you know, pretty much ailing advertising platform. They tried to go up against Google's AdSense platform, and they're not doing that well. It actually lost money last year. But you tap into all that Facebook stuff and combine that with the ad auction and all the stuff that Microsoft has basically cloned off of Google, you get something pretty powerful and also pretty scary in terms of privacy.
Yeah, I think if our students were listening to this, though, I think they would just kind of roll their eyes at us, because for them, that's not the issue. I think for a whole younger generation of people who use these social networking platforms, it's the opposite question, which is, how can I get more people to know me? And
absolutely.
So there's this whole culture of self-exposure online that is so embedded in youth culture today. I mean, I just, you know, talking to my students about it all the time, I say, you know, you got to remember that you don't want things that are in your Facebook profile to show up on your job application. And we have an alum in the history department who works downtown in a white collar job, and part of her job is to check people's Facebook profiles. As they get down to the sort of finalist status, she checks their Facebook profiles for the partners in her firm, and they've nixed a couple of people because of photographs that were posted in their profile and that were, you know, fairly embarrassing, that would be embarrassing to the firm if they showed up. And some of these people had really gold-plated resumes, and in one case I know the job candidate was just so shocked that she hadn't gotten the job offer that she contacted our alum and said, you know, "Can you explain this to me?" And so our alum emailed her the picture from Facebook that had nixed her application. According to our alums, this student was just shocked that anybody would have even seen that. And, and so she lost out on a great job with a, you know, pretty important firm downtown, but it's a political firm and, you know, doing lobbying work. And so they're just not going to hire that person.
I find that, I mean, I've heard similar stories. I just heard one the other night at a dinner party. A friend of mine was interviewing, you know, a young kid just out of college for a job. And he had a really, you know, a very good resume. And he wasn't even doing anything that could be considered risque or really even any, all he did was he wrote something on his MySpace page that said, "Boy, I'm really tired of Washington. I can't wait to get out of here. I can't wait to move back to New York." And he was interviewing for a job in Washington. And my friend asked him, like, with the question you asked, like, "We're looking for someone to stay for at least a year. Are you planning to stay in Washington?" And he said, "Oh, well, you know, definitely." And she said, "Well, I looked at your Facebook page and it said, you can't wait to get out of here." And he, you know, turned bright red and apologized. And, you know, it was sort of, they kind of nodded at each other, and there was clearly an understanding that he wasn't going to get the job. But it doesn't even have to be something so, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, pictures of you drunk or pictures of you scantily clad or anything else. It can be something simple like that, something that's seemingly innocuous. And I think a lot of students don't know that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, the strange way that Facebook's work, you can also, it doesn't necessarily have to be something on your profile. I mean, what if your friend posts photograph of you or writes something on your wall or you know does something stupid? It's just out there, and this just totally agitates against the standard. You know, for 20 years as information technology has become more and more important on campus, I mean, privacy has been one of these big things. I mean, we block off our email systems. We block off, you know, courseware oftentimes, which, as we've discussed in a prior podcast, we're opposed to. We want our syllabi out there. But it's been a very internal thing. You know, what goes on in the university, you know, stays in the university. And I think all of these tools are just sort of breaking down that wall. And I think that combined with the fact that you can take something like a Facebook profile and match it up with, if this social ads thing really works, I mean, where you surf, where you, you know, Microsoft, of course, has a search engine as well. I mean, you could combine all this information and pretty much have a very full picture of a student or faculty. Imagine if you could find out, you know, let's just push this out as far as possible. But let's say you use Library Thing, the great service that lists what books you like or what books you have on your bookshelves. All those profiles tend to be open. You could combine that with other information. I mean, what else do you need? It's you don't even need to be the CIA. You can find out pretty much everything about a person: what they read, what they shop for, what bands they like, who they're friends with. It's a pretty scary prospect for, you know, what used to be a very walled off environment.
But I think, like I said, it's scary for us. It's not scary for the younger generation coming along behind us.
And I think the one thing that sort of mitigates against some of this is the fact that it's so easy to build the next Facebook. And I mean, I think, you know, people argue, well, now everybody's on Facebook, so they're not going to leave. Well, that's true, except for the kids who are 7 and 8 years old right now. They're not on anything. And they may decide when they're 13 that Facebook's not cool anymore. That's where my parents are. And they may start something new, or they may find something new. And I wouldn't bet the farm on this, but I would think that 5 years from now, there's going to be something other than Facebook. And now, yes, and that will have its own privacy issues. But that this is going to kind of move from one thing to the next. And so we won't end up in – I just don't think we're going to end up in a situation where we have another Microsoft or even where Google becomes so dominant because of the web and because the web is so flexible and the internet, it's so easy to put something online where, for instance, it's not easy to distribute software and packages. I think that provides for enough kind of churn in the system that it won't be that some, you know, big evil company owns all the data and has kind of a monopoly on it. I think that and that mitigates against some of these concerns.
I think that's a great point, Tom. And actually, I did see a survey of 18 to 24 year olds recently where they were asked a bunch of questions about online use. And one of the conclusions of the survey was that indeed they like Facebook, but they said it's like on the cusp of being uncool. That was the conclusion of the survey, which I think is totally, I think it's totally right. As we've gotten on, and I just look around, you know, like my people who have friended me who are in the younger age group, I don't see them like using it as much as I expected I would when I logged on. So I guess we'll see what happens and who will take over from Facebook in the future. And it's time once again for Picks of the Week, the way we like to end the podcast, by going around and mentioning sites, tools, things we've seen online and off that might interest our listeners. Mills, why don't we begin with you today?
All right, well, I'm going to start with an article from the New York Magazine that was actually, I got the heads up on this from Ken Albers, who's our doctoral student who does the technical work on the podcast. It's from earlier in the year. It's not actually dated on the page online, but it's about what we've just been talking about in the podcast. The title is by Emily Nussbaum, and it's the headline is "Say Everything," and then the subhead says, "As younger people reveal their private lives on the internet, the older generation, that would be us, looks on with alarm and misapprehension not seen since the early days of rock and roll. The future belongs to the uninhibited." And it profiles three different young people in New York City who participate in this culture of self-exposure and why they do it and how they feel about it. So it's a really interesting kind of insider view as opposed to our outsider view.
Huh, sounds great. Okay. And we will link to that, of course, from digitalcampus.tv as we link to everything we mentioned on the podcast. Tom, what would you like to mention on the podcast?
I'd like to mention a blog that a friend of ours has started, Josh Greenberg at the New York Public Library. He's set up. His new title there is, I think it's Director of Digital Strategy, and he has set up a New York Public Library Labs, where they're experimenting with new library technologies, new web technologies for displaying library materials, for building exhibitions, for doing all the things that libraries do. And his group there, that labs group, and there are some very smart people working there, are blogging their process as they work through these different tools and work on these different projects. And it's some of it's kind of inside baseball, so some of it sometimes doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it's kind of an internal blog, but it's available to the general public, and it's a pretty interesting window into just kind of what a big operation like the New York Public Library is working on and thinking about in terms of digital issues. So it's worth a look. They post fairly regularly, maybe a couple times a week. It's at labs.nypl.org.
It's a great, really interesting blog. I totally agree. And it's great to see Josh, I think, pushing for this to make the process open. I think it's a great site for people in, particularly in the library world, but I think just in general, and, you know, academic and museum worlds as well, to sort of see what's going on as they try to make you know, put up new kinds of directories and tools on the NYPL site, exhibits as well. So I think a great blog to keep track of. I'm a day one subscriber to that one, and thanks for mentioning it, Tom. For this week, I actually have, since Mills mentioned New York, I thought I'd go with The New Yorker, an article in The New Yorker by a historian who's very important in my life, Anthony Grafton, who's course I took when I was a freshman on Renaissance intellectual history and really got me interested in intellectual history, and I really owe a tremendous sort of intellectual debt to Tony Grafton. He's one of the smartest people you'll ever meet, and he's got a really great article in The New Yorker called Future Reading, and it's just about all of the digitization projects that are going on, like Google Books and the Million Book Project at Carnegie Mellon and the Open Content Alliance that's being headed up by the Internet Archive. And he just sort of goes through. I mean, here's a historian who really has done his work in, you know, old texts. I mean, literally some of the first printed materials. But is really interested in what's going on online with all of these materials being made available, and what it might do to scholarship and reading, and where the line between the library and the sort of mythical, what he calls the universal library that's being digitized, and whether it is universal. So I think it's a great overview article, and it just says a lot of smart things in it. Mentions a lot of the projects that we've mentioned on the podcast before. And it's got a very long URL, so again, we'll link to it from our site. And again, as always, we encourage people to go to our site at digitalcampus.tv, and also to email us at feedback@digitalcampus.tv. We love getting emails, and we try to mention them on the podcast when we get them, and respond to comments that we get on the blog as well. And we'll see you there, and of course, looking forward to having you join us again for our next podcast in 2 weeks on Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.